Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
So our second speaker is Josh Francis. So Josh is a paediatrician and infectious disease specialist. He works at the Royal Darwin Hospital in the Northern Territory in Australia, which is a fascinating place to live and work. He also does a lot of work in Timor-Leste, which is only 1 hour flight from Darwin, but it's like going from a high-income country to a low-income country. So I think he's got some fascinating stuff to talk about. So welcome, Josh.
Thanks very much, Anne. And thanks very much to Don't Forget the Bubbles for the chance to be back at the conference and here in London to be able to talk about what's a pretty difficult topic, actually, sexually transmitted infections. I was in this place about a week and a half ago, and it's hard to imagine anywhere that would be further from London than here. This is in West Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory, a bit outside of Kakadu. If you've been to the Northern Territory, some of you might have been to Kakadu, and if you keep on driving as you get out of Kakadu, you lose the bitumen roads and you head out into Arnhem Land, land that is Aboriginal-owned land. And this place, a place called Oempele, I think is one of the most beautiful places in the world, actually, as you drive through there. And it's a beautiful road, but it's a pretty difficult one. I've ruined one car several times on it, and it died its final death after a trip out on that road about a year ago. And we took a different car out this time. But it's this beautiful, spectacular journey that is difficult. And we're talking about adolescence this afternoon. It's an interesting journey. I think it can be fairly difficult, actually. I am now a father of adolescents, which blows my mind a little bit. I've come to England with a 14-year-old and another daughter who'll turn 13 while we're here, and a couple of younger kids. So adolescence is I'm describing it early on in this journey as a father, a beautiful but maybe sometimes difficult journey. But I'm conscious that for my kids travelling through adolescence, they are travelling through adolescence in such a privileged, wonderful position, actually. And it will be bumpy. We've all been adolescents before, and they'll have their ups and downs. But when I look at some of the kids that I look after through their adolescence, whether it be in the Northern Territory or in Timor-Leste, I am struck by how difficult this road can be for so many. And so the stuff that I'm going to talk about in the next 15 or 20 minutes are some really difficult stories, actually. Some difficult stories that paint a very rocky picture of adolescence as we talk about sexually transmitted infections. It's a pretty sobering topic to have, actually, but I think important stuff for us to turn our minds to. And one of the things that I would love you to grasp as we talk through this is that sexually transmitted infections, like so many other diseases, are diseases that you can think of as diseases associated with disadvantage, associated with poverty, diseases that disproportionately affect the poor and the disadvantaged in our world. And I think being mindful of that, whether you're living here in the UK or in Australia or elsewhere in the world, I think is really important in terms of how we conceive the delivery of healthcare. And this difficult journey doesn't just start in adolescence. I mean, I think all of us would realise that it starts much earlier. And I wanted to tell you this story at the start of this talk, and it's a confronting one. And to be honest, I grappled with changing the age of this child to make it sound less confronting than it is, because this is a confronting story. This is a 5-year-old whose care I was involved in, who presented with a right hip septic arthritis, but a fairly indolent presentation with low fevers and fairly low inflammatory markers, not very impressive, not your typical terrible Staph aureus disease that we are used to seeing in the Northern Territory in Australia. He had a joint aspirate which showed a leukocytosis, but it was a mild leukocytosis, maybe 40 or 50,000 white cells. The fevers and the joint pain continued in spite of being treated with flucloxacillin and vancomycin, which we would use to treat Staph aureus. And this boy presented with septic arthritis in a context where the burden of sexually transmitted infections is incredibly high. And this is a graph from a paper that was published in 2016 describing the burden of osteoarticular infections in children in the Northern Territory of Australia. And so this is looking not at adults, specifically at children, what are the main causes of bone and joint infections? And a graph that comes out of that describing the cases of septic arthritis highlights for you that in the Northern Territory, we see more cases of gonococcal arthritis than we see of Staph aureus septic arthritis, which is incredibly confronting for me. And this young child had presented with gonococcal arthritis and received appropriate antibiotic treatment, but as you can imagine, a social situation that required a lot more than just the antibiotics. And came at a fairly dreadful run, actually. And so this gives you perhaps a little snapshot of some of the cases that we saw over a fairly short period of time. This is in very recent history. And two of the three siblings of this child also had gonorrhea. Over a similar time period, we had a couple of other cases of gonococcal arthritis, a 13-year-old with severe pelvic inflammatory disease, another case that hasn't fit onto this slide that I'll come back to a little bit later in the talk. And I guess all of this to paint a picture for you of a really confronting situation with a very high burden of sexually transmitted infections. And if I describe it this way, you'll get a sense of the burden that is faced, and not uniquely, but predominantly, by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people living in the north of Australia. And so this is from some work done out of the Kirby Institute, which is based in Sydney, but looking at the impact of sexually transmitted infections on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia. And it's looking here at the gonorrhea notification rate per 100,000 population, and this is for 2017, divided by Indigenous status, sex and age group. And you can see this incredibly high burden in very young people who identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. And in fact, if you pick out the numbers there, you're looking at 2,000 per 100,000 per year. So we're saying 2% per year. So 2% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people aged 15 to 19 having gonorrhea per year. So an extraordinary ongoing epidemic of gonorrhea amongst our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people in Australia. And to put this in perspective, it means that they're about 30 times more likely to have gonorrhea than their non-Indigenous peers. And the comparison, if you want to compare with here in the UK, the incidence of gonorrhea notifications in the UK is around 75 per 100,000 per year. So this is 2,000 compared to 75. It's an extraordinary difference. And I'm saying all this because I think understanding this context, if you want to think about the management of sexually transmitted infections in adolescents and young people, is so important because this is the picture, this is the reality that we're talking about. We're talking about a disease that certainly in my context in Australia disproportionately affects one part of the population, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people. The epidemiology is also important because it impacts significantly on treatment. And to continue talking about gonorrhea and to touch on the fact that we are seeing emerging gonorrhea resistance, certainly in Australia and New Zealand, Australia, New Zealand, and in the UK. I'm in the UK, I know, it's a long journey to get here. If you look back last year, there are reports out of the UK and Australia of three of the first cases of extensively drug-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea. And there's some data that you can look at that sees the emergence of particularly ceftriaxone resistance amongst gonorrhea. And ceftriaxone, many of you will know, is our first-line treatment for Neisseria gonorrhea. And in contexts like the UK and in Australia, and in fact even recommended by WHO for the global treatment of Neisseria gonorrhea, is to use ceftriaxone and azithromycin together. And there's some really good rationale for that. One of the strongest rationales is that you cover your bases and you treat chlamydia as well, and the two often go hand in hand. But there's also this recognition that we are starting to see the emergence of ceftriaxone resistance, and azithromycin is there to help cover for the ceftriaxone resistant isolates. But in three cases, two in Australia, one in the UK last year, the reports of extensively drug-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea in cases that were resistant to ceftriaxone and azithromycin, and there have been a trickle of further cases since. And so this emerging problem for us makes it hard to manage these three patients, but these three patients weren't even adolescents, and I'm talking at a paediatric conference, so in one way you might say, well, best of luck to them. But I guess what this says for us is that this is a problem that can only become bigger unless we find a better way to address it. And the different ways of addressing antimicrobial resistance are to keep on inventing newer and fancier drugs, or to take a step back and say, how do we change this and stop it from happening in the first place? How do we look at mechanisms for preventing the transmission of infections like Neisseria gonorrhea? Gonorrhea, if I say to you is common, it becomes something that we do have to know something about. And I'm not here to compare incidence rates, but in my context, knowing about gonorrhea and knowing how to treat it becomes hugely important. And I think that many of you would be aware that gonorrhea can present like this. I mean, this is a very simplistic way of describing it. It's not meant to be a Talian O'Connor or some sort of a comprehensive description of the clinical presentation of gonorrhea. But if you think of it like this, it can cause pain, it can cause bleeding, it can cause discharge. Many paediatricians in the room whose experience with gonorrhea would be in seeing or thinking about babies with gonococcal conjunctivitis does the same thing in the eyes as it does in the nether region. So pain, redness, bleeding, discharge. But the thing to realise with gonorrhea, like other sexually transmitted infections, it can also be completely asymptomatic. And in fact, it's quite commonly asymptomatic, particularly in females. And so being aware of this, I think, is crucial, because if you're aware that it's often asymptomatic, you're aware that this can transmit without causing symptoms, and you're aware that you have to think in terms of a strategy for testing and treating that doesn't just rely exclusively on somebody presenting with urethral discharge or vaginal discharge. And so offering testing to people with symptoms is crucial, but also, in our context, speaking into a crowd interested in adolescent medicine, sexually active teenagers should be tested for sexually transmitted infections. They automatically find themselves into an at-risk group. And even if you look back at my slide before of 15 to 19-year-olds or 20 to 24-year-olds who aren't in an extremely high-risk group like Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids in Australia, they still fit into a risk group where if they are sexually active, they should be offered routine testing without prejudice. And so this is a really important point from my point of view to make, and it's crucial in our context in the Northern Territory that we offer this to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young kids. But it's something to keep in mind in your practice generally. And in fact, reducing the stigma and the blame around testing for sexually transmitted infections is actually a really important strategy for being able to find and detect cases to treat them and to prevent transmission as well as to prevent the complications of the sexually transmitted infections themselves. I've got a slide that flicks us across to chlamydia, and the slide doesn't change very much. You'll notice that it changes the picture. I am an infectious diseases specialist, and I do think that microorganisms are quite beautiful, so I'm happy for you to look at them for a little bit. So this is a picture of gonococcus. Tends to go in pairs, which and so it's a people sometimes call it a diplococcus. The chlamydia bacteria looks quite different. So this is like a whole heap of chlamydia in together within the cell. So they kind of, this is an artist's impression, but they're abutting the nucleus there. It's an important part of understanding chlamydia and how it works. It's an intracellular pathogen, so you get a heap of chlamydia into the cell. It's one of the things that makes it hard to treat. It's one of the things that makes azithromycin a really good treatment for it, because azithromycin gets out of the bloodstream and concentrates into the cell, so it's a really good treatment for this. It's one of the reasons why it's really hard to do prophylactic treatment for chlamydia, because you're looking to get into cells that are actually already infected. So somebody who's, in a sense, latently infected and waiting for that chlamydia to present might not respond to azithromycin. But that's distracting from the points I've got on the slide here, which is to say that chlamydia is similar to gonorrhea in the sense that it's often asymptomatic. So it can cause pain and bleeding and discharge. And like the neonate who might get eye disease, where the chlamydia eye disease tends to be a little less purulent, a little less painful, a little less red, that you can think of it similarly with chlamydia when it's causing infections, genital infections. But very importantly to recognise that chlamydia is often asymptomatic. And again, with the same message as before, that testing, even in the absence of symptoms, becomes a really important part, an important strategy for treating sexually transmitted infections and reducing transmission. So I want to talk a little bit about that strategy of testing preemptively, if you like, testing because somebody's at risk. And it's a strategy that we know works, and it's a strategy where, in my home country of Australia, it's a really obvious part of what we need to do. And so we've got guidelines in the Northern Territory from the Centre for Disease Control that state that these are the sort of things that we should be doing. We should be doing annual STI testing of asymptomatic people, rapid treatment for those who've got symptoms, who have a positive test, follow-up test of cure 3 months after a sexually transmitted infection, testing and treatment of named sexual partners, safer sex and STI prevention education at every consult. So these are some principles of an effective STI management program. And these are the principles that are embedded in our guidelines in the Northern Territory, and I don't think you could argue with them. If you want to, then ask a question later. But they're kind of sensible, you know, like it's saying, this is a problem, we need to get on top of this problem, so we need to test and treat and to make sure that we're doing education at the same time. So I said my home country of Australia. I feel very at home in Darwin, but I also have this second home in Timor-Leste. As Anne said, it's an hour flight from Darwin. It's very close to home in that sense. These are neighbours, and for me, very much family. And so you go and you find yourself in this other country that's right on the doorstep of a wealthy country like Australia. And what do you find? You find a context that's so entirely different, it's almost unrecognisable. And even just to pick out this issue of sexually transmitted infections and say, well, what is the approach there? What we settle for in a country like Timor-Leste, where the burden of sexually transmitted infections is likely to be as high, is an approach that the WHO has put forward for many years, saying a syndromic approach to management of STI. So if somebody presents with discharge, urethral discharge or vaginal discharge, then give them treatment, get them to come back in a week if it hasn't worked. Now, you can see that this is not the wrong thing to do for somebody with urethral discharge. I mean, it's good to give them ceftriaxone and azithromycin and to hope that they get better and see them again in a week. But it's such an inadequate response to a public health crisis. And I guess I make that point today, having highlighted the problem amongst Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the north of Australia, to say that I don't know what the scale of the problem is in Timor-Leste, because we don't have the tools to do it. We don't have the laboratory diagnostics to do it, and we certainly haven't at this stage got the public health system with the capacity to do the sort of surveillance that would tell us what the problems are and to be able to identify the sort of strategies that could work. And we settle for that, and I say we in the sense of thinking of ourselves as a global community. There's people from all over the world here, maybe mostly Australia and the UK, but that spans a fair bit of the world. It took a long time to get here, and you fly over a lot of countries on the way. And as a world, we look at this and we kind of sit with it and say, well, that's okay, this is how it should be for Australia, and this will do for Timor-Leste. I don't know how much time I've got, and I could talk about this all day, so let me carry on, because there's a couple of other stories that I want to bring into this, because I've painted a bit of a journey so far, a little bit of a story about the epidemiology, but I got this call not very long ago, it'd probably be a month ago, about a 12-year-old who'd been sexually assaulted by an unknown assailant. And so what do you do, how do you think about in the context of getting almost, 12-year-old's an adolescent now, I can ask an adolescent physician in the room, 12-year-olds who have moved on from the very young children, but in this context of a very young adolescent who's been sexually assaulted, this is a common scenario to encounter in your emergency departments. And I haven't come today to give you your ED guideline for post-exposure prophylaxis or to try and get you to rewrite yours, but just to think a little bit, because this is an important context for thinking about STIs in young people. And we think often in these contexts about managing the risk of hepatitis B, and certainly in our context in the Northern Territory, where the prevalence of hepatitis B in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population is over 3%. And the thing about hepatitis B is really important in terms of, is this child hepatitis B immune, and do they need to receive passive and active immunisation for hepatitis B? But often the fear and the worry is around HIV. And the risk of HIV transmission in the setting of a single encounter is nicely documented in this table that comes out of the UK, actually, from the British HIV Association. And it's a really good way of thinking about the risk in this sort of context, because if you look at the risk that the perpetrator has HIV, and then you multiply that by the risk associated with the act that's occurred, then you get a sense of what the absolute risk is in that context. And in some ways, this is a reassuring table, actually, because what it shows you is that in the setting of a single episode of sexual assault, the risk of transmission is actually going to be relatively low. And it does depend on what the baseline risk is of the person who perpetrated the assault having HIV. Not a lot of time to go into that in detail. Happy to take some questions about it later. But what happens as the journey goes on, and the next thing you hear is that you get this 14-year-old who presents with their first pregnancy. What sort of infections will you test for? What are the important infections you'd think of, thinking about sexually transmitted infections in a 14-year-old during pregnancy? You can call them out. Syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia. Hepatitis B, Hep C, HIV, a really important consideration. And these are important for a variety of reasons. They're important because of the risk of congenital infection. They're important because of the potential to intervene, to make a difference in it. And this happened in the same period as we had those other cases that I was listing for you at the beginning there, this 14-year-old who, with their pregnancy, was found to have chlamydia, gonorrhea, trichomonas vaginalis, and syphilis. And this happened in the context of an ongoing terrible outbreak of syphilis, and I keep showing you awful numbers, but these are some more to show, and these are out of Australia that show an ongoing, this is through to April 2019, an ongoing syphilis outbreak that's occurring right across the north of Australia. It's spread starting out of Queensland, but has come across to the Northern Territory, Western Australia, and also in parts of South Australia, affecting predominantly Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with an almost unprecedented, certainly in recent history, outbreak of syphilis. And so this young mum, infected with syphilis in the context of what is essentially a social problem, it's a public health emergency, it's a public health disaster, and happens in the context where we've looked at the data from the last 5 years, and almost 1% of young Aboriginal mothers who are pregnant in the Northern Territory, have given birth to babies in the Northern Territory, have babies who are at risk of congenital syphilis. And so the burden that we're talking about is enormous, and the impact of the sexually transmitted infection is not just on the adolescent, but then obviously carrying through to risk for the baby as well. And so it leads us to a public health response where frequent antenatal testing is required, adequate treatment of the mother is crucial, and to reduce the risk of congenital syphilis requires ideally no syphilis in the first place. Second best option is to treat the syphilis before they're pregnant. Otherwise, treating syphilis during the pregnancy reduces the risk from being high risk down to what we would call low risk, but an opportunity also for empiric treatment of babies who are at risk, and importantly for good follow-up. I could talk all afternoon, I can't. I think I've used up my time almost right to the very end of it. But the points that I would love you to take away from this, and I say take home points, as I wrote that on a slide this morning, I was thinking actually about the World News Service in Australia that has a byline that says news from home if you're from the world, or something like that. Anyway, these are take home points. Think of them as take to the world points, because I think that these are points that are important whether you're working here in the UK, or you're working back where I work in Australia, or if you're interested in global health, to think more broadly about the impact not just of sexually transmitted infections, but other diseases that disproportionately affect the poor and the disadvantaged in our world. And think about what are the effective strategies that we've got to manage these public health problems, and how can they be employed in a way that actually reaches to the people who need them most, and not just to the ones who are less at risk. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh. Any questions from the floor? Okay, I can see there in the middle.
Just wondering, with the universal screening, how low do you go? What age do you start at, given the stories you told us?
Yeah, it's a good question, and not an easy one to answer, actually. It's a pretty sensitive topic, and I hope that you'll all appreciate that for a lot of this, even these data are sensitive to present, and I'd appreciate people being sensitive in the way that it's shared, even beyond this on Twitter and things like that, because these are hard stories. Like, I don't share these stories lightly at all. The guidelines in the Northern Territory suggest screening from 15 years of age, and that's done in a fairly sensitive way, but also with recommendations that for those who are sexually active prior to that, they should also be tested, but that should be done in consultation with a specialist. Difficult, though.
Any other questions?
Just a quick one about how you approach consent for screening in a 12-year-old, for instance, where a family might be part of the problem.
Yeah, I haven't got a magic solution to that. Questions around how you approach consent in a 12-year-old, but I think it has to involve the family, and it has to involve the child, and at times, like you're managing the situation across not just cultural barriers but language barriers as well. And I think it would be wrong of me to suggest I had an easy answer to it, because I would take those situations individually one at a time. And for the most part, it does involve, it has almost exclusively involved, being able to sit with the family and be really honest.
On Twitter?
Yeah, we've got a few questions for you through Twitter. So I can kind of make this into a two-part question. So Erica has asked, how do we balance emphasising the seriousness of STIs while also not making them feel like we're being judgmental? And following on from that, Do you think that the association between deprivation and STDs is one of the reasons that there's a lot of shame, and that's why young people don't present when they're symptomatic?
So the questions are around how do you balance the seriousness of the STIs against not making somebody feel guilty for having one. And again, I think these are hard conversations that people who enjoy talking to young people and their families almost relish, although I think sometimes you'd run away from it if you could. But I think that for me, a big part of that is being able to emphasise for the adolescent, for the family, how treatable these are, and how good it is to find it and be able to treat it. I mean, that tends to be my approach to what is not a straightforward situation at all. But then also to be able to turn that around and to talk about the sort of choices that that they can make to help protect themselves in the future. I think it's possible to put a positive spin on it, actually. When you're in that situation and you've got the diagnosis, there's a pretty good outcome in terms of being able to treat them and make them well. The second question around the association with social deprivation and the contribution then to shame, I think, I mean, it's possible, and I think that the complex interplay of poverty versus living in a remote location versus other risk factors that come in, I probably haven't done justice during this talk and would take a lot longer to tease out, and I think would require a lot more discussion, not just with us here in this room, but with some of the people and the families and the communities who are involved and affected as well. So I don't think it's easy to point your finger to this or this or this as the particular reason, but I think it is important for us to tell it how it is and to be really honest with ourselves about these problems so that we can think carefully and to think, particularly in conversation with the communities affected, how we can develop together community-led strategies to address it.
Thanks. In the interest of time, we're going to move on, but please find Josh at the end if you have any further questions. Put your hands together.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy.